thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we welcome back one of our favorite guests, film critic John Kenneth Muir. Mr. Muir has a brand new book out titled Horror Films FAQ, and in it, he explores the past century of the cinematic horror film genre by decoding what those films say about us and the world we live in. You can purchase the book right here from our show page, and you can read more of Mr. Muir's intensely satisfying film criticism at his website at reflectionsonfilmandtelevision.blogspot.com. So tell me what the kind of modus operandi was with horror films, frequently asked questions. What was your mission here?
Well, you know, the FAQ series is this umbrella book title, you know, and they have like the Doors FAQ and the Beatles FAQ, and so my mission was to sort of explain horror movies in this book, and obviously that's like a huge that's a huge thing to try to explain, and you know there's also a film noir FAQ, for instance, and so you know there are some things that they say. You know, every FAQ book is going to have, it has to have at least 30 chapters. You know, you have to sort of you sort of have to arrange it in a consistent way with the series, you know, which is great and actually helpful when you're, you know, trying to organize a book. But, you know, I decided, you know, really what I needed to do was sort of, you know, describe, you know, sort of what the players are in horror. And for me, that's, you know, the basically the film directors, but also the monsters, because horror movies tend to be organized not by really the heroes, although in some cases that's true. You know, you have Ash in the Evil Dead movies. He's sort of an exception. But mostly it's like the boogeyman. You know, it's like, you know, the Frankenstein monster, Dracula, Jason, Michael, Chucky, Candyman. You know, you can go on and on down the line. Most horror films are, you know, the character who recurs is the monster. So, you know, I knew I was going to look at directors, and I knew I was going to look at boogeymen. But for me, you know, what the joy of doing the book was that I was able to sort of explain, you know, how horror works as a vehicle for social commentary, how it works in terms of structure, and how that idea that horror reflects the society and, you know, that horror, you know, is structured in a certain way, that applied over all of these different subgenres. You know, I have this, you know, some people define horror very narrowly, and what I wanted to do with the book was show you how, well, a lot of things fit under the horror rubric, and it's because they all do things in a certain way in terms of structure and in terms of what they achieve. So that's why you have, like, evil children films, you have ghost films, you have Japanese remakes, you know. I was able to, you know, cover the whole, you know, the whole panoply of horror that way by looking at different sort of subgenres of the form. And then that got me to my 30 chapters, because I realized, you know, very soon that I was going to have, you know, many, many subgenres to talk about once you get into, okay, there are vampires, there are slashers, there are, you know, werewolves, there's found footage films, you know, and I hope when somebody's reading it, they can see sort of what the connection is between all these, but, you know, how horror talks about culture and things like that.
Well, that's what I've always loved about your criticism, especially in the realm of horror, because horror is a genre that a lot of people very flippantly dismiss, and you bring out in your writing the relevancy of the genre and how it's a reflection on us as a people, and that makes me curious about, when considering the history of horror, you know, if some other life form was trying to figure us out hundreds of years from now, could they look to our horror films to kind of gauge what scared us through our history, and that would be a great indication of who we were at different times?
Oh, that's great. I mean, I that's a brilliant question, and I think absolutely. I think that horror films, for me, the appeal of them is that they really cut through sort of the noise around the culture, and that, you know, they're very blunt and they're very honest. They're about what they seem to be about. You know, they handle, you know, the things in the culture that we don't necessarily want to face, and that we don't really put in our, you know, our mainstream, Oscar-nominated dramas every year. You know, if an alien were to look at, horror films, they would have a catalog of what feared us and when. And when those things, I mean, you know, what scared us and when those things scared us as a culture. I mean, you can go, you know, up and down, you know, through the decades and say, okay, you know, at the dawn of the atomic age, we were terrified by what we had unloosed. And you look at the 1950s films like Them, for instance, with the giant ants, you know, coming in the desert to, you know, attack humanity after being exposed to radiation, you know, things like that. You think, okay, you know, they were afraid of, you know, their technological advancement. You know, if you go to, the 70s, you know, so many of the 70s horror films deal with conspiracy and cover up with second wave feminism, things like that. You know, a culture that was shifting, you know, sex roles at the time, you know, and the fear of, you know, losing tradition and something new beginning. You could just go on and on down the line. You know, in the 80s, you know, the sort of the Reagan revolution and the conservative ascendance, you have, you know, these slasher films which reinforce the idea of if you behave badly and immorally, you'll be punished. I think aliens would be smart to look at our horror films, you know, because, you know, if you looked at a Merchant and Ivory film, you know, which could be a great film, in 1990, but you're like, why are they looking, you know, why in 1990 are you making a period piece from, you know, the turn of the century? You know, it may be a great film, but it's not necessarily relevant to the psyche. You know, the great thing about horror movies is that they're always relevant to our sort of national and individual psyche, I think, is that, you know, a horror movie isn't a horror movie unless it's scaring you about something that's happening now. And that's why horror films, even though we love them, will lose their, you know, currency over time. I mean, I love Dracula and Frankenstein from the 1930s. They're great films, and you can point out why they're great films technically and how beautiful the shots are and how they came out of German Expressionism and things like that. But, it tends to be that those films like Dracula and Frankenstein 3 don't scare us today. We can admire them for their artistry, but they don't scare us the way a found footage film scares us today. You know, and I imagine in 50 years, you know, a found footage film won't scare the people in because, you know, as the culture grows, you outgrow what the terror and fear was of the previous generation. And mm-hmm. I guess there was a big article, you know, there was an article recently about Halloween, how it no longer scares young people, you know, and I think, oh, you know, that's my generation. Of course, Halloween is terrifying, John Carpenter's Halloween. But, you know, I guess they got a bunch of, under 20 folks, and they said, you know, this doesn't really scare us anymore. And, you know, I know some people were really offended by that, but that's just the nature of how it is. That doesn't mean you can't still love the film and admire its artistry. It just means that you know where the culture is, you know, the fear has changed, so different fears are going to be relevant to that age group.
Yeah, and also something that comes to mind, if aliens looked over our horror films hundreds of years from now, they would discover that we were really frightened of them, particularly in the 50s. So, oh, they're
right.
Scared of us. Yeah.
Right, so, the UFO scare, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you talked about you mentioned the Draculas and the Frankensteins. Tell me what the Universal horror films, what those expressed about their time.
Well, I think they expressed a couple of really important things about that time. One of them was, what the history of film was. Well, you know, like I said, you know, bringing German Expressionism over into American film and using that mode of almost surreal, dreamlike sets and things like that to scare us. I mean, that's how the terror was expressed. It was expressed through production design and setting and ambiance and stuff like that. But also, you know, Dracula and Frankenstein are interesting because they actually, you know, came from literary works that were much earlier. But, you know, it seems like maybe the culture hadn't moved on yet from them in the 1930s. And what you have there is this sort of fear of the foreign other. Dracula is this aristocrat from another state that is believed to be primitive, a superstitious state of mind. And so this is very important in terms of, the Gothic tradition, which is about the battle between, you know, rationalism or enlightenment and, you know, romance and superstition. And so, you have this figure in Dracula who is coming into an age of technology, which is actually, you know, exemplified by film, you know, in, you know, coming in the early 1900s, you know, things like in psychology, you had hypnotism, yeah, and, you know, you had film, you know, all these things were happening, all of these irrational things were happening where technology was coming to our aid, but the fear was still that something outside that technology was going to harm us. Something outside this rationality or reason could still exist and still get us. So that's really, I think, what Dracula is. It is the sort of the response to the age of technology, and you know it came after World War I, but before World War II, where you were seeing the really the negative impact of technology on the world. So Dracula, you know, interestingly, is he's a throwback to another time, but in some ways people also view him as a hero. And the same with the Frankenstein monster. I think in both those cases you have a monster who is outside the norm, and even though you're kind of scared of him and he may be awful, there's also something appealing that you recognize in him, or something pitiable that you recognize him. And you could probably say the same thing would be true for King Kong, from 1933, is that there's something magnificent about them too. And so people who feel that they don't belong or that they're outside, society's conventions often land on Dracula or Frankenstein, saying, you know, that's what we're talking about here, the derided other, whether that could represent immigration or homosexuality, or anything, race that is outside the norm of mainstream society. I think those films really trade in those ideas.
I was talking to Gunnar Hansen last month, and we were talking, trying to kind of tap into, you know, what did the audience tap into with that original Texas Chainsaw? And his idea was similar to what you just expressed. It was the idea of the other that's out there in your backyard, you know, that society that you know nothing about and is completely foreign to you. Do you agree with that take?
I think that is definitely a part of it because, you know, you're talking about America being a melting pot. I mean, it always has been. There's always been this nativist strain in America where we look at people who came after us, maybe, you know, immigrants, and like, they have different traditions, and because I don't know those traditions, they are frightening to me. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be involved with immigration. I mean, you saw in the 60s in movies like Easy Rider, like, the fear, you know, outside the South, of the South, you know, really plays into films like Easy Rider and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, this feeling that you're entering this sort of, a pocket universe where what you assume to be the dictates of nature and law don't really exist or apply as you believe they would. So I guess, you know, maybe it's not just nativism, but regionalism. So I think that's a valid point. But the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, I mean, it's the perfect horror film because it also does what only the very best horror films do, and it unsettles you not just by what you see, but how you see it, and it explodes conventional movie structure, and that's the thing that makes it so fascinating and so terrifying. I mean, Leatherface is, you know, an incredible monster, but it's how we see him and how we see the people who encounter him that I think is what matters, because, people don't really recognize the Texas Chainsaw Massacre as such, but it's to the 70s and the development of 70s horror what Psycho was to the development of 60s horror. You know, Ralph Hitchcock in the 60s had to restore order. There's no restoration of order in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There's just a, you know, Leatherface spinning around crazily, you know. There was still learning in Psycho. The characters learned, even though we lost Janet Leigh's Marion Crane, your point of identification changed to Sam Loomis. Well, first it went to the detective, and then it went to, you know, Sam Loomis, and it developed. You had the information, and you went from character to character as they all learned the pieces of the puzzle for the final revelation about Norman Bates. in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, there's no learning at all. Nobody learns anything. People walk in one after another into the farmhouse and get hit over the head and killed. You know, there's no sense of learning and no resolution. So you know, again, it just totally corkscrewed the structure of traditional Hollywood films, and that's the thing that's so scary about it, is that it doesn't feel like your typical Hollywood movie. Because it destroyed the kind of decorum and structure we expected, it became much more real to us, in a sense.
You know, every time I talk to you, we always go back to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and selfishly, because it is my favorite horror film. I mean, it's one of my favorite films, period. And I just got a chance to watch it on the big screen for the very first time in this old classic movie palace. It was an ideal setting, and it blew me away. I mean, it was the most effective viewing I've had of that movie since the very first time I saw it.
Lucky dog.
I know, it was so great. And something struck me. I think the key to, in terms of the sense of dread it raises in me, I think the key to that is the movie seems to have a complete indifference to death. It just happens, it kind of pans over it, and it goes on. I mean, it's an unrelenting movie that doesn't stop to come, and it doesn't build up into, you know, isn't this thrilling? You know, they're about to get killed, and it doesn't have any of that. It's indifferent.
Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's so interesting, because when I look at the movie, I see again and again all these symbols of order overturned. You know, I talk about the structure, you know, sort of overturning Hollywood order. But you look at the film and the overturning of other orders. You know, there's the roadkill on the road with its feet up. You know, there's first shots of the film are of a dead body out of a grave instead of in the grave. And you know, it's just this idea of total disorder and, like you said, indifference to life and death. There are so many of these shots from like a long distance. You see the van driving, for instance, in a very long shot, and the camera is so far back you can hardly see it. You see sky and other things. You can hardly see the van moving across the landscape. You know, or other shots where the sun is very prominent in the frame, and people, you know, are moving through the frame, but you're seeing the sun. What you're registering in your head is the constancy of the sun and the inconstancy of the people. You know, we don't matter. We're like the little bugs in that web that they find in their house skittering around, but the universe doesn't care about us any more than it cares about those bugs. I think that's a huge part of it too. I mean, we could probably could talk about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre forever. There are so many elements that make it successful, and I think it's one of the, you know, really one of the two or three most important titles in horror history. And if people don't see it, I think it's because they don't like the title. You know, I would watch something called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but in its own way, it's a film that's as great or maybe greater than Psycho, and certainly it's as important in the horror canon as Psycho is.
Well, and I think it works on the level of suggestion just as strongly as Psycho does. I think the most graphic thing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre is its title, because it promises something that you imagine that you've been shown and you really haven't. I mean, the technical aspects of the film are flawless. Do you think, because you cover film directors in many of your books and you summarize a lot of them in this book, do you think they're aware of what they're tapping into, or are they just kind of, unbeknownst to them, they're kind of tapping into the id, you know?
I think it's a combination. I think they know what they're going for. You know, they're all, you know, very talented, intelligent, you know, artistic folks. But I do think there's some element of it that once they get to it, that it's like it is summoned up from you know, they know. I guess this is the way to say it. They know how to translate into symbolic imagery those things in the id which are effective. I think the best director, you know, De Palma, I put Tobe Hooper in there, man. I put Tobe Hooper right up there. That they are able to effectively translate from their psyche, from their id, onto the screen in the symbolic imagery we watch on film. Now, the final part of that is that the culture has to be ready for it. The culture has to be sort of heading in the same place, maybe unknowingly, and then the film taps it, and it's like a stick of dynamite being lit. It's like, wow, and then it all comes together, you know? And, I mean, we've seen that happen. You know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was a huge hit, but obviously Halloween did that. I mean, Halloween just took off. Even Scream in the 1990s picked up on something like that. You know, something about the VCR generation coming of age, something about the pop culture that, you know, was eating itself and, you know, constantly referring to things that had happened before. You know, so, you know, all the allusions to previous horror movies and stuff. That the really great horror films, they not only translate an individual fear, but they meet with culture that is maybe unconsciously ready to grapple with that particular thing. And, you know, I think that's what makes, you know, a film like Blair Witch or whatever, Scream, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw, and probably, you know, Psycho as well, and maybe going back, Dracula, King Kong, you know, all those films. That somehow it's the union of all those things together, because the culture has to be kind of going there in that direction too for the film to really take off.
Do you feel like our fears, what scares us, do you feel like it's constantly evolving into something else, or do you feel in some way that it's cyclical, like these trends return every once in a while?
I do think, it's hard to say exactly. I think it's evolving in one direction, you know, and we don't know where that direction is going to take us. But I do think sometimes you get a resurgence of something that came back, you know, that was present earlier. I mean, you know, the first decade of the 21st century, you know, with war, unpopular wars and things like that, you know, is very similar in context to what was going on in the late 60s and early 70s with Vietnam. So you had some of that 60s, 70s vibe coming into, you know, back into the culture, even though the culture had moved on. What's different, you know, again, is visual presentation. You know, I always say the arc of film history is from the very theatrical or artificial towards the naturalistic and gritty. And, you know, so that means we don't accept, you know, the convention of somebody breaking into song in a musical like we would have in the 1930s, you know. There has to be a reason for it. we accept Wookiees and monsters and TIE Flayers and all that easily today, but we don't accept, like, someone would just break into song, you know, and, you know, films have become less stagey and more realistic. So even if a trend as far as what scares us recurs, how it's going to come back is very different. You know, the found footage films, you know, in some ways they deal with the uncertainty that we saw in 1970s films, the ambiguity and uncertainty, and the sort of secular approach. You know, you films like Hills Have Eyes, Last House on the Left, you know, where the villains were not supernatural, they were human, you know, even if they were sort of barely human, you know, inbred human, something like that. They were still mostly human. You know, they weren't Dracula or Frankenstein monster. But, you know, so I think you kind of get that in a lot of these found footage films where, like the Blair Witch Project, where is it supernatural? Is it not? We can't really determine. Is there even anything there? You know, but I think the found footage formula, you know, it's saying we're removing even more distance. We're becoming even more naturalistic and realistic. We're taking away the theatricality of having a third person be the camera. Now the camera's incorporating the story, and you're looking right through it at us, and we don't acknowledge, and we acknowledge that the camera is there, and, you know, it's like, even though the trends recur, the way it's recurring is different. It's becoming more and more immediate, and it's becoming less and less between us and our fears. You know, we don't want a very artificial horror movie anymore, because it wouldn't scare us, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm also thinking of something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which that story's been told several times on film, and each time it's made during a different time period, and with the exception of probably the last one, I think they all work, because they all tap into something we're going through now, and maybe it's a universal thing that's been around since the first one was made in the 50s, I believe. But that's an extremely pliable plot.
Right. Well, it's so perfect because, you know, in terms of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you're talking about people who you think you know aren't what they seem to be. And the 1950s one, you know, dumped onto that idea, you know, either the idea of McCarthyism or the idea of communism. It's like the people who you think you love are actually communists, or they're actually like McCarthyites, and they're going to, you know, make you name names, you know. And then in the 70s, they poured into the same idea of you don't really know the people in your life. They poured on the idea of the me generation and, you know, and self-help books and the idea that we've become, you know, these isolated islands and we don't really want to know anybody. So, like, the connection is not possible, and so the aliens slip in. And then in the 90s, what they dumped in was the political correctness of the era. I mean, there's just that great scene in the movie where all the little kids in school draw the exact same picture except the human. They're all aliens and he's human. And he's, you know, they look at him and he's sent home because he did something different. You know, the idea of the conformity of the political correctness movement of the early to mid-90s. So, you know, that has such a, the invasion of the body snatchers has this very generalized anxiety. And so it's really easy then to say, well, what is bothering, what's separating people? You know, and let's put that in and make the alien sort of a comment on that. But it's brilliant. I mean, I agree. And, you know, the one in 2007 should have found some way to do that. You know, I'm just baffled that it wasn't able to somehow come up with sort of a more meaningful representation for the aliens. You know, in the middle of the war on terror, you know, and all the talk of red states and blue states, they should have been able to do something about how we're divided by, you know, our politics or ideology or something, but it really didn't do much like that, unfortunately.
I agree. I think we're due for another good version of it. But that 70s version is particularly brilliant for me, the Philip Kaufman, mostly because of how it uses the environment of San Francisco, which is really like the ideal place to set that story because that's where you go to be your own person. That's where the individual is supposed to thrive in that environment.
Oh, that's a brilliant observation about it. Yes, I think you're right. And, you know, it was also, you know, playing on the, you know, the whole post-Watergate era and, you know, the idea of, you know, these sort of faceless, nameless people, you know, tapping your phone and, you know, observing you from, you know, two cars back, you know, that kind of, and just looking at you and you feel like, you know, the paranoia of just that you're being watched, you know, it's Big Brother is watching you or something like that. And, of course, it isn't. It's aliens in the film. But still, you know, there's just that whole Watergate scandal vibe from that film, I think.
Yeah, and we've never felt Big Brother as heavily as we are today. So maybe
right.
That's the angle they should take, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this is a kind of an ongoing conversation that we have on the show whenever a new film comes out that I think belongs in the horror genre, and one of my other hosts say, no, it's a thriller. I think the last time we spoke about it was the film The Purge, which I saw, you know, I saw more on the horror side. And
right, it's horror.
My co-host said, no, it's a home invasion thriller. And I said, no, it's not Mel Gibson in Ransom. It's not that kind of thriller. It's
right.
Made to horrify you, I thought. What's the
I agree with you. Well, you know, this is, you know, I do talk about this some in the book. People want to, like, close down horror into a box, and some people say that box is, it must have some element of the supernatural. And I say, well, you cannot do that because then you lose Halloween, you lose the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you lose Psycho, you lose Silence of the Lambs. I say, so, you know, you lose the Friday the 13th movies for the most part have no supernatural element until much later in the films. You know, he's reanimated by lightning at one point, becomes a zombie or something. But, you know, that's like six or seven films in. So you're telling me you're going to pick all those up and say those are not horror and move them into the thriller camp? That doesn't work. You know, that just doesn't work. I can't think of any self-respecting horror fan who says, yes, let's remove Psycho and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Silence of the Lambs and John Carpenter's Halloween. Let's cordon them off and put them, you know, in the thriller category. You know, it just doesn't work. I think the intent is very important, and that's what you alluded to with The Purge. The intent is clearly to horrify you, and it's also clearly to use some aspect of the culture to bring up that horror. I mean, you know, The Purge, I mean, it was perfect because what it was about, I mean, what it seemed to be about was, you know, that 47% comment that was made in the last election, you know, and that certain people are more equal than other people, and certain people, and in the movie they extended that to sort of ridiculous Heights. It's like, well, you know, don't get in the way of my right to kill you, you know, because you're a moocher and a taker. You know, you're at 47%, so it's my right on this night to kill you. I mean, that's when you cut down to what the Purge was about. That's what it's about. And it's about somebody finding out he doesn't like being having his family put into that category, you know, but that's what happens. You know, it's about this one segment of the population, you know, preying on the other, preying on people who can't defend themselves, who aren't rich. So, you know, it was very much of our times, and that's exactly what a horror movie does. Thrillers, I mean, you look at something, I mean, I love thrillers, but, you know, I think something more along the line of, like, golly, I don't know, maybe that would be an action movie. I say Lethal Weapon or something like that. Thrillers don't tend to cut beneath the surface the way a horror film does, the way a film like The Purge does. They tend to be more about manipulating you on sort of more surface levels, I would say. So, I mean, I do readily admit I have a pretty expansive definition of horror, but I think that's the only way to do it, or you lose titles that clearly belong there. You know, I guess some people could say Last House on the Left isn't horror, but to me, I mean, it's clearly horror.
Last House on the Left is one of the purest examples of horror that I could think of. But on the other end of the spectrum, I think when I think of a thriller, I think of a John Grisham movie. You know, no one would accuse
Film
of being a horror movie. You know, it's
right.
It's totally
good way. Good example. Right. No, that says it. That says it. It's very different. I mean, the intent in The Purge is to scare the hell out of you and to sort of put you in that situation where you're experiencing two stories. On the surface, you're experiencing this sort of story about a family dealing with a home invasion, and there may be thriller aspects to that. But on the other level, you're dealing with the logical outcome of a certain theory of ideology, and that's what a horror movie does. It brings out something in the culture, and it either exaggerates it or modifies it a little, and tries to scare you with that. So I think that's what The Purge does.
So Jaws, you would say, is a horror film. I mean, it's included here in your book.
Yes, Jaws is a horror film. You know, Jaws is really interesting. You know, my theory on Jaws is that, you know, the shark is you know, an avatar for something other than just an animal. That you know, when animal attack movies, the animal represents something more than just an animal. You know, and in Jaws, I think the shark is representative of sort of blowback. You know, it arrives, I think, literally to the day, 35 years after the Indianapolis, after the Indianapolis incident. And the Indianapolis, what was it doing? It was delivering an atom bomb to the plane that was going to then drop it on Japan, you know. And then what the shark does is it comes and attacks us where it hurts in our economy. It destroys the economy of this American town, you know, and the person that it takes down is, of course, the person who survived the Indianapolis, like it's coming back for him. So the shark represents something more than just a shark there. You know, and you see intimations of that in the film, and that it seems it's too big, it's too powerful, it's too smart to be a shark. You know, there's some element of that monster that is more than just an animal intelligence. So yeah, I put Jaws as a horror movie, definitely.
You know, we went through a trend in film with the set off by the Saw series, where Carnage was king, and then we kind of reverted back with the success of the Blair Witch and Paranormal Activity, which came many years later, but into a trend that was very promising to me, because it really encouraged audiences to be active participants. I mean, they were paying attention to every corner of the frame in a way that they don't with most movies, which I loved about the paranormal films. But I feel like Hollywood always does, when they find a successful formula, they play it to death until they kill it. So I feel like we're at the end of that found footage. Where are we going from here? Where are we now?
That's a good question. And I honestly can't predict what the next trend is going to be. But I think your point is a good one. And if you look at it, if you look historically at the horror film, you see that is exactly what happens. Halloween was a huge success Friday the 13th, the first Friday the 13th is brilliant, but through infinite seeming repetition, you know, happy birthday to me, my bloody Valentine, blah, 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 the thing that was scary about those movies, it faded away, and you know, familiarity breeds contempt, so the slasher died. Just like you said, the torture porn movies, which I think are a valid expression of horror movies. I'm not down on the Saw movies, but we got so many of those that we ran those out. And then the found footage film rose, and you know, we're gonna bleed that one out next. You know, as soon as something becomes so familiar that it doesn't scare us anymore, horror has to move on. And then those movies become the province of people like me, like fans. It's like, man, I'll go back and watch all those slasher movies because I love the minutia. Like, oh, okay, look, you know, there's a red herring character in all these slasher films, and he's always blue collar, whereas the other victims are white collar, and they blame the red herring being the blue collar character, you know, as being the killer, but he's not. You know, you can look at all these, you know, great aspects of those films, you know, and sort of organize them, but they don't have the vibrancy anymore that they did when they first came out, when the trend was new. You know, as far as what's next, I can't imagine. I mean, I think it's going to have to be about what is the divide in our culture and how, you know, people can not decide, you know, what kind of culture is this going to be. Is it going to be, you know, essentially white culture, you know, as it's been in the past, or is it going to be a multifaceted culture? You know, do we become, you know, more accepting of immigrants, of gay marriage, of things like that, or do we step back and say, no, we're not going to do any of that? You know, that conflict, that tension, I mean, something, you know, I feel like the horror movie at some point is going to have to take that on. It's going to have to take that on and say, this is what's happened, and, you know, this is where we're going. But I don't know what form it would take. You know, you can't imagine. I couldn't have imagined the found footage form, really, you know, being so effective. And, you know, I don't think I foresaw, you know, torture porn either, although it made sense. Or the Japanese remake phase, you know, that one is especially odd to me because you take all the cultural fears in Japan, and we have very different cultural fears here, and yet they imported them, and, you know, for a span of a couple of years, you know, with The Grudge and The Ring, you know, those remakes really worked here, you know, which is sort of goes against my belief that, you know, horror films are culture-based, you know?
I think about the period of time when we were concerned with nuclear holocaust and the effects of radiation exposure and all of that, and we had the gigantic insect films as kind of an offshoot of that. Do you think that something similar might happen with climate change, what we're going through with global warming in a way?
I do, you know, that's a really good question, and I recently was writing about Soylent Green, which was, you know, a film in 1973, which isn't horror, it's science fiction, but they were suffering, you know, overpopulation and famine, and, you know, because of, you know, they were talking about greenhouse gases and global warming, essentially in 1973, and they were able to apply it to a science fiction film. I think global warming, you know, horror is in some way more personal. It's like, how are we going to get that, you know, how is global warming going to become the monster that gets into your house and threatens you? You know, nuclear, the apocalypse mentality of the 1980s, we were able to do a lot with that as far as, you know, the horror movies, you know, you had mutants and, you know, things like that, you know, it's like, that's a very specific fear, you know, this, you know, slobbering mutant out in the desert, you know, and he's going to kill you. I don't know how to do that with global warming almost. I mean, it's a threat that's out there, but, you know, how do you personalize it? I mean, probably, you know, I expect the global warming tradition will migrate mostly into disaster films, which is, again, you know, another category that sort of goes between. It's like, okay, you know, because what it's going to do is, I mean, it's going to destroy whole swaths of property. It's going to, you know, sink cities like London and Manhattan, you know, and again, it's almost disaster. The disaster films are much less personal films. Those you stand back and watch the spectacle of, you know, whole cities falling, you know, under volcanoes or in earthquakes or whatever. So, you know, someone more inventive than me could probably come up with a way to make global warming a horror concern. But I don't know how you'd do it at this point. You know, like, because horror is so personal. It's so personal. It's like, you know, it's at your door. You know, it's there. You know, it's knocking at your door. And, you know, how are you gonna fight? I guess what they could do is, you know, set it in a sort of post-apocalyptic setting where, you know, displaced populations, you know, are swarming into your cities. But, you know, in a sense, you know, that kind of story has already occupied space in our zeitgeist with the zombie films like World War Z and, you know, The Walking Dead on TV and stuff like that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I just have two more quick questions for you, and then I'll let you off the hook. But the zombie craze, I mean, The Walking Dead is the biggest show on television, network or cable. It beats football. I mean, it beats Sunday Night Football, which is amazing. And you know, obviously, zombies are back in a big way. Why? Why do you think?
I think that zombies are back in a big way because the zombie films and television shows are always about the collapse of infrastructure. That, you know, your garbage is not going to be picked up, the trains will not run on time. Literally, you know, government collapses, and we have so much going on in the country as far as, like, you know, you can't trust government. Government is bad, you know. You twist that with this idea of something, you know, something needs to happen. And when that something happens, we're all going to be better off. We're going to build something out of the ashes of the bad stuff now, and eventually it'll be better. It's like partially self-destructive, and it's partially wish fulfillment. It's like, man, you know, I'm tired of Big Brother, you know. I long for the day. It's like the days of the Old West, you know, except instead of Indians, there are zombies. You know, you have your gun. You defend your family with your gun, and you don't like, that's the law. That is the law. You know what I'm saying? And I think that the zombie films sort of tap into this idea across all these different parties of, this is not sustainable. You know, something is going wrong. We're falling apart as a country. And we both fear that happening, and there's some aspect of us that wants it, I think. And I think the zombie stories really play into that, because the people, you know, in The Walking Dead or you know, the Night of the Living Dead films, you know, at the very least, they are their own agents. You know, nobody's, you know, you know, no death panels for them, you know.
Right.
They're the agents of their own destiny. They haven't been tamed by the quote-unquote nanny state. Now, I'm not placing, I'm not placing a judgment on government or, you know, people who believe that or whatever. I'm just saying that I think that's the stew that has made Walking Dead popular. But also, I mean, I'm addicted to the show, but I also know in some sense that it's a lot like the Battlestar Galactica of the last decade, and people get really upset when I point this out, but that it's very soap opera-ish, operas do pull you in, and you know, that some people say, you know, Battlestar Galactica, Walking Dead are the greatest things to happen to science fiction and horror television. And I have to step back a minute and say, wait a minute, One Life to Live was doing those stories in the 1970s. All you've done is added robots or zombies. You know, that's not necessarily maturity in storytelling. And I think that's what George Romero was trying to say, is that Walking Dead has in some sense substituted soap opera dramatics, which are wonderful. I love the show on that basis, for what he did, which was using the zombie allegorically for problems in the culture. You know, now the zombie is almost literally running on automatic pilot. You know, we carry with it all these beliefs, like I said, about, you know, what does it represent? And The Walking Dead simply has to tap that and tell stories about people we like, and it's immensely popular. I'm not saying it's a bad show. I'm just saying that if you compare that with something like Survival of the Dead, which audiences hated, but which was literally an allegory for our presence in Iraq, I mean, one work of art is working symbolically and allegorically, and the other is a soap opera. I mean, we have to acknowledge that fact that, you know, there's grades, there's differences there. And I do love Walking Dead. I do. I'm not trying to put it down. I'm just saying
I love it. I love it, too. But there's also the element of, I think that we're, you know, it's probably not there, but this was just a thought that occurred to me. I think that we're longing to feel empowered and start from scratch in a way.
Yes.
And I think the same thing applies to something like Breaking Bad. how can we reinvent this and empower ourselves, reinvent our lives? And do you feel that way?
I do because the show that I'm binge watching now and that I'm also addicted to is Sons of Anarchy, and that is also really about empowering yourself outside of the existing culture and governmental structure. It's about sort of a different code and you know, making your own way. I think there's a lot of that. I think what you said is absolutely true, and I guess that's why, you know, I think when I think of wish fulfillment, it's like, man, it's people longing to take control of their lives back. But you know, that's where the culture gets so screwy, because, you know, it's like, you know, get your government hands off my Medicare. You know what I'm saying? It's like we're expressing this wish, you know, to be free and to not have these things, but you know, but we also really like having, you know.
Yeah.
Best, you know, really good healthcare. You know, we also like having electricity. You know, we like, you know, we like having our fire stations and our libraries and, you know, and all these things the government does. You know, it's nice to have bridges. You know, it's, we're in a very weird place in our culture. It's like, you know,
yeah.
I hate all things government.
Very schizophrenic.
But,
yeah, I agree.
Exactly, but take your hands off my Medicare. You know, I need that. And I said, wow, right? Which is, you know, what's going on? I mean, that is the great schizophrenic aspect of our culture, and I think the zombies definitely play on that idea, because what the zombies do is that they flood infrastructure so that infrastructure doesn't work. They leave the government impotent and powerless, and the individual citizen has to step up and be responsible for his or her own life, and his or her family's life. And you know, I think that's what's being expressed there. I don't think the zombies are going to go anywhere soon. Although we you know, there are so many zombie productions at this point.
Yeah. Well, I can't let you go without asking about the remake of Carrie. You've seen it, I take it.
I have not. I am so sorry. I have not
really?
Seen the remake of Carrie. Brian De Palma is just, you know, to me, he is one of the greatest directors in movie history. I know that his film was an adaptation of a Stephen King novel, and that novel could be readapted in the exact same way that Stoker's Dracula has been adapted and readapted over years, and there's nothing wrong with it. I can't object to it. I just can't imagine telling that particular story better, and that's probably my own fault. But I just love his use of split screens. I just love the original character. So tell me about the remake then. Am I wrong?
Your suspicions are dead on correct. Because
okay.
I mean, you and I share that in common. I mean, I think that De Palma as a god among filmmakers. So yes. I'm very precious about his work as well. I was so excited that Kimberly Pierce was directing, and I said, well, this might be an interesting take on Carrie. And the thing of it is that there's no, it doesn't seem like her heart was in it at all. It doesn't seem like a take on anything. It's first of all, you can't beat the technical wizardry of De Palma and the way he puts films together. So,
right.
You know, you gotta tell it very conventionally, because you're not going to compete with him in that regard. It's impotent, the movie. And it could have been, I think, a prime time to return to Carrie, because the issue of bullying has
right.
kind of reached a crescendo. But
hoping
they'd find something new, but they were stuck. I mean, between trying to veer in a different direction and remaining loyal to the source material in De Palma's original film, you could see that conflict when you watched the movie.
Oh.
It just didn't work.
Well, you know, I always hark back to an interview I did with an editor, and that interview is in my book, Horror Films of the 80s, where he was one of the editors on Fright Night, the original Fright Night in 1985. Oh. And that film is a lot of fun. It's a really great 1980s horror film, and it's full of subtext. It's just absolutely filled with subtext, with it, like, the idea that the vampire and his live-in guy might have a homosexual relationship is played in there a little bit. You know, there's all sorts of undercurrents of sexuality, and sort of applying that to the outsider status of vampires in that movie. But the, you know, the editor told me when I talked to him, he said, yeah, he said, that was all intent. He said the director wanted that. He said he wanted to express every aspect of that idea. And so we took care of that, you know, in the editing, you know, made sure that it came out and stuff like that. And I said, well, do you still do it? He said they literally have a rule now that you cannot have subtext in the movie. He said, you can't. He said, you know, in a big Hollywood movie, he said, you can't. He said, they will not let you. And he told me about one movie he worked on, which sounds funny that it would have subtext, but he said, you know, he said the live-action Scooby-Doo from 2002, he said, I worked on that. He said it was, like, brilliant. There was this whole subtext through the whole movie, and he said they made us cut every single minute of it out. Every single minute. You know? And you think, wow. First of all, that Scooby-Doo would have had subtext, but secondly, that you know, that this is a rule. It's like, no, don't go there. And that, to me, that's what's really sad, because then movies are losing what they are. And that means what the future is for horror has to be on the fringe. It has to be in the independent movement. And you see that, I think, in films like Greg Holcrew's Dawning, or The Invoking, which is a new movie coming out, or I watched a brilliant movie recently. I say, you know, Cabin in the Woods was smart, but this is like a much smarter version of Cabin in the Woods. It's called Resolution. These are these tiny budgeted films, and they're exploring things the way, you know, Tobe Hooper did, or Wes Craven did in the mid-70s. And I just think that's probably where the next trend is going to come from. It's going to come from somebody independent like that who makes a horror film outside the system where they're still allowed to express something beneath the surface, I think.
¶¶